Support for TPR comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping employers get their people home safely. Preventing workplace accidents protects families and keeps businesses productive. More at texasmutual.com.
From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, as we prepare to witness the April 8th total eclipse in Texas, we look back at the Great American Eclipse of 1878 that crossed Texas and the American frontier. It was a watershed event for American science.
Because this was a time when the sun itself was a great mystery. What is that great ball of fire in the sky? What is it made of? What fuels it?
This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. On April 8th, the moon will move directly in front of the sun. Its shadow will be cast down onto Earth, giving us a total eclipse. The path of totality in the United States will begin in Eagle Pass and then cross into the Hill Country, swing over to Waco, then Dallas, and then out into Arkansas and beyond. It's a rare event, but not a singular one. Eclipses happen every so often, but some are more dramatic than others, and that could be said of the Great American Eclipse of 1878. This eclipse crossed the American Wild West frontier, including Texas, and it was seen as an opportunity to celebrate the expansive nation that the reunited U.S. had become, and was also a chance to show off America's growing expertise in science. David Barron wrote about it in his book, American Eclipse, A Nation's Epic Race to Catch the Shadow of the Moon and Win the Glory of the World.
When I discovered that in 1878, a total solar eclipse crossed America's Wild West at a time when the United States was just starting to prove itself as a scientific nation, and eclipses were really important for science at that time, and among the scientists who came out to the West that year was Thomas Edison, I knew there was a story here, and the deeper and deeper I got into investigating it, the more fascinating it became.
So it wasn't just Edison. You track a number of other scientists as they went out west to see the eclipse. This was a time when going to the West, the railroad was a thing now, but still not very convenient. Why would they go to the West to view an eclipse?
So today, of course, a total solar eclipse is just a wonderful natural marvel. And I tell you, folks in San Antonio and Austin and along the path of totality in Texas are getting a real treat. It really is an amazing thing to see. But back in the 19th century, total eclipses weren't just fascinating things to marvel at. They were keenly important for the study of astronomy, because this was a time when the sun itself was a great mystery. What is that great ball of fire in the sky? What is it made of? What fuels it? And there were certain studies of the sun that could only be done during a total solar eclipse. And this is something that happens usually about once every 18 months somewhere on the planet, often someplace very hard to get to, a total eclipse will occur. And so in the 19th century, this scientist would put together these elaborate expeditions to go to India or North Africa or up to the Arctic to set up their equipment in the path where the moon's shadow would fall and hope that clouds didn't show up. And then in literally about 3 minutes of total eclipse, they would frantically conduct these experiments to try to resolve these mysteries about the sun and the solar system. So it's often, in fact, been called the golden age of eclipse expeditions, the late 19th century. So there are many eclipses during that era that were very interesting. And I had decided I wanted to write about that era, but I really wanted to bring it to life with one eclipse. And the eclipse of 1878 just had everything going for it, especially, of course, for an American audience. There were these great characters in this fascinating place, the Wild West, at a really interesting time. This is the beginning of the Gilded Age in the East, and a critical time for American science. Sort of like the moon landing in 1969, the eclipse of 1878 was this scientific event that captured the public's imagination and really made America want to show what it could do on the global stage, to show we could be a scientific power. And that 1878 eclipse was an important stepping stone toward the United States becoming the global superpower in science by the 20th century.
So it wasn't just Edison. You track a number of other scientists as they went out west to see the eclipse. Why did they, this was a time when going to the west, you know, the railroad was a thing now, but still not very convenient. Why would they go to the west to view an eclipse?
Absolutely. I mean, the Europeans looked down their noses at us. The United States by 1878 was definitely an economic power. But when it came to intellectual pursuits, to great art and music and literature and science, the Europeans thought the United States really wasn't much to consider. And in fact, some people thought that the United States would never embrace science because we were a democracy. It was thought that it was these old monarchies of Europe and these countries where the elites were in control, that they cared about lofty things like science. But why would a democracy care? And so when you have an event like a total eclipse that gets everyone excited about science, that's keenly important for a democracy to decide, well, the general public cares about this stuff. So yes, in 1878, the folks in the U.S. felt like they were frowned upon, and they were. And this was a chance for us to show Europe that we could be and should be taken seriously when it came to science.
So Thomas Edison goes out there. He's 31 years old. Many of his great inventions have yet to be put forth. So talk about what kind of a figure was he at this time?
I had so much fun learning about Thomas Edison. I mean, he's become this legend. And I think most of us, when we think of Thomas Edison, we think of this old man who is a huge celebrity and an icon. But as you said, in 1878, Thomas Edison was almost a kid. I mean, he was 31 years old, this clean-shaven young man in an era when everyone else had beards. All the men had beards. But he had just become a global celebrity because he had just the year before invented the phonograph. And the phonograph was an absolute sensation. It's hard to believe it today, but until Edison invented the phonograph, no one even imagined that it would ever be possible to capture and release sound. It's like capturing an echo and releasing it at will. So he had suddenly been launched to celebrity, and he was just a very, very colorful character. You can see why the press loved him. He spoke in sound bites. He was a very folksy kind of guy. And he was also part of the reason why the 1878 eclipse got the public so excited, because young Thomas Edison was going out to the Wild West. And in fact, there was a reporter from the New York Herald who was assigned to follow him, and other reporters were interviewing him along the way. So he added his own celebrity to the eclipse. But I should add, in 1878, he was, of course, already becoming known as an inventor. But at that stage of his life, he wanted to be more than an inventor. He wanted to be a scientist who was studying nature and solving the great mysteries of the basic forces of nature. And so he went to Wyoming with some scientists to show what he could do in science. And he brought along an invention he came up with specifically to study the sun during the eclipse.
So he has his own hype machine. He knew how to work the media to his advantage. In a lot of ways, he's kind of like today's Elon Musk, except without the fascism.
Yeah, it really is remarkable how Steve Jobs, the late Steve Jobs. I mean, to be a successful inventor / entrepreneur, I think you need to be a showman or showwoman as well. And he certainly was. Thomas Edison knew how to hype things. And sometimes he hyped things that ended up being absolute flops. But other times he hyped things that literally changed the world, like his light bulb. A big part of his success was not just his brilliance in the lab, but his brilliance in speaking to the press and getting people excited.
So, but when he went out to the West to see the eclipse and take part in the scientific observations, he brought one of his new inventions with him. And what was the expectation for this device?
Right. Well, so this device was called the tizimeter. And at the time, he was hyping it, and the newspapers were hyping it as it was going to be bigger than the phonograph. Well, you can probably guess how that turned out, because I would suspect most folks have never heard of the tizimeter. I certainly hadn't before I started work on this book. But the tizimeter was an extremely sensitive heat detector, basically an electric thermometer that he claimed could detect changes in temperature as small as 1/1,000,000th of a degree Fahrenheit. And it did sort of work. It was what we would today call an infrared detector. You could point it at something, and it would pick up the heat rays coming off of it. And he was going to use his tizimeter during the total eclipse to point it at what you will see around the dark moon during a total eclipse, and that's the solar corona. Today, we know the solar corona is the sun's outer atmosphere. And in fact, it's extraordinarily hot, over 1,000,000 degrees. But back then, no one knew what this strange and beautiful thing was. They weren't even sure it was part of the sun. They thought maybe it was something in our own atmosphere that you would see during a total eclipse. And Edison was going to point his tizimeter at the solar corona to see if he could measure heat coming off of it. In the end, his tizimeter was not a very effective device. It could detect heat, but it couldn't measure it precisely in any way. So his results were not useful. His tizimeter did not live up to the hype. But the very day after he returned from Wyoming to his laboratory in New Jersey, he started work on the light bulb. And he used the same hype machine that he used on the tizimeter for the light bulb. And that actually bought him time. He was hyping the light bulb for a good long time, about a year, before he even knew if it would work. He was telling everyone he'd solved the problem of electric light, but he hadn't until he finally did.
Right, and he wasn't the only one pursuing the light bulb. He was in a race with other people, and he was throwing his brute force of trial and error at it. And so he wasn't really seen as a scientist who could theorize and come up with exotic hypotheses and then test that hypothesis and publish data. He was seen as a tinkerer. Was he challenged by that?
Yeah, he did not like the fact that he got that reputation. And honestly, I think he doesn't quite deserve that reputation. He did think things through. I mean, he did use theory, but then he used brute force. And then the most famous example is when he finally solved the problem of electric lighting. One of the key parts of his light bulb was the filament, the thin part inside the light bulb in an incandescent light that gets hot and gives off light. And he tried thousands of different substances before he finally settled on bamboo fiber for his light. And in that case, yeah, he just tried everything until he found the solution. But in many of the things he did apply theory as well. But he resented being called a tinkerer. And that's part of what he was trying to avoid when he went to Wyoming to show he was a scientist. But in the end, he's known as an inventor, not a basic scientist.
So what about the myth that Edison turned to bamboo fiber because he was using a bamboo fishing pole when he was on that trip out west?
Yeah, actually, there's a historical marker in Wyoming at a place called Battle Lake, where he did go fishing right after the eclipse. And the claim is that when he was at Battle Lake fishing, he was using a bamboo fishing pole. It broke. And that evening, he threw it into the campfire. And he noticed how the threads of bamboo glowed as embers as they got hot. And that gave him the idea to use bamboo in his light bulb. I've looked into it. That's a pure legend. That's not how he came up with the bamboo in his light bulb. However, the trip out west for the eclipse really was important for his development of the light bulb, in part because he had tested out his hype machine on the tizimeter, which he then used for the light bulb, but also, and perhaps more importantly, because he had burned himself out in the lab, and the trip out west was a vacation that kind of restored his energy. And he was traveling with scientists who encouraged him to take on the problem of electric light and power. And they were giving him ideas. And when he got back to New Jersey, he took their ideas and remembered those conversations and turned his attention to electric lighting.
So there were other scientists on this trip, lots of different trips, people going different locations all through the path of totality. Tell me about James Craig Watson. What was he known for and what was he doing out there?
Sure. So James Craig Watson was an astronomer from the University of Michigan. He was a pompous ass. He was a smart, ambitious jerk, but very, very talented at one particular skill, which was discovering asteroids. Now, asteroids are, of course, small objects in our solar system that orbit around the sun, most of them between Mars and Jupiter. Back then, finding asteroids was still a big deal. Not very many had been found, and they orbit the sun just like the large planets do, and they were considered planets. Asteroids were called minor planets, and they were given names just like the major planets. So James Craig Watson was in a race with other astronomers to find the most asteroids. But in 1878, he went west for the total solar eclipse to find something even more impressive than another minor planet, another asteroid. He was going to look for a major planet, a planet called Vulcan, which before it ever ended up on Star Trek as a made-up planet, back in the 19th century, Vulcan was thought to be a real planet. And it was thought to exist between Mercury and the Sun. So if you look at a solar system chart from the 19th century, some of them will show that the planets go Vulcan, Mercury, Venus, Earth. Now, Vulcan at the time was a hypothetical planet. No one had reliably seen it, but they thought that it had to exist because Mercury's orbit didn't make sense otherwise. Mercury behaved as if there was some mass between it and the sun that was tugging it along. So astronomers said, well, there's probably a planet, maybe there are several planets between Mercury and the sun. They gave the planet the name Vulcan. James Craig Watson thought, well, why have people never found this planet? If it's that close to the sun, it can't be in the sky at night because it sets with the sun. And you're not going to see it in the daytime because it's going to be lost in the sun's glare. The only time you might catch a glimpse of this planet Vulcan would be during a total solar eclipse when the moon blocks the bright face of the sun, enabling you to look at what's right around the sun. And James Craig Watson was determined to be the man who would finally find the planet Vulcan.
I don't imagine he did find it.
Well, he thought he did. And in fact, the big headline to come out of the eclipse of 1878 was Vulcan found. And James Craig Watson is the man who has finally found this planet. I mean, and the European astronomers were sending him letters of congratulation. As I recall, Alexander Graham Bell sent him a letter of congratulation for finding Vulcan. But as you, of course, I think probably all your listeners know, Mercury is the closest planet to the sun. There is no Vulcan. James Craig Watson had deluded himself. In the end, he probably saw what was just a star, but he thought that it was Vulcan. And he ended up dying convinced that he was right. And in fact, he worked himself into the ground trying to convince other people that he really had found Vulcan.
So there were these multiple scientific camps set out there to along the path of totality, looking to study the sun because it was still pretty mysterious at the time, and any sort of observation could be revolutionary. But there was one that was made entirely of women. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, many people find this the most interesting part of the story and the most interesting character, and that is an astronomer named Mariah Mitchell. Now, Mariah Mitchell, back in 1878, she was by far the most famous female scientist in America at a time when, of course, there really weren't very many. She was an astronomer. She taught astronomy at Vassar College, which at the time was a new all-women's college in Poughkeepsie, New York. And this was a time when, of course, you can imagine it was not easy to be a female scientist. But in fact, higher education for women overall was thought to be a risky social experiment. And a book had come out just a short time earlier by a very prominent Boston doctor claiming that higher education was bad for a woman's health. He claimed in all seriousness that if a young woman used her brain too much, it would sap energy from other parts of her body, her maturing body, including her reproductive organs, and it would turn her into a sterile masculine invalid. And there was this fear spreading across America about whether this was such a good idea to start opening women's colleges. Well, Mariah Mitchell thought this was ridiculous. She encouraged her students to use their brains in her astronomy courses at Vassar. But that wasn't enough. She needed to convince American society that this book was rubbish. And so in 1878, when there were these teams of men assembling eclipse expeditions out to the Wild West, many of them supported by the U.S. government, they were getting logistical support and money to go out west. Women were excluded. Mariah Mitchell took it upon herself to assemble an all-female expedition to Denver. And it was a scientific expedition, just like the ones that the men were putting together, but it had a whole other layer of meaning, and that is, it was kind of political theater. It was a chance to show the general public that women could be smart and educated and healthy and feminine as well. And there's just this wonderful photograph that's included in my book of the Vassar College Eclipse Party in Denver, and it's these women in Victorian dresses sitting out by their telescopes on the plains of Colorado, getting ready for the moon's shadow to set in.
I just want to highlight this book by this Dr. Clark, Sex in Education. And the book it sold out. This was not just a minor book. And this anti-feminism subject that he took on and tried to use a Darwinian theory to back it up and support it, of course, today is laughable. But at the time, this was considered science.
Well, and in fact, in order to refute Dr. Clark's book, Sex in Education, research was needed. And there were then afterwards studies done of tracking the menstrual cycles of women in college and seeing that using their brains didn't make any difference, and seeing if female college graduates were less healthy than women who didn't go to college. So in order to refute his book in the end, it required data. So Mariah Mitchell was one step in trying to refute his book, but it took some time before that idea was laid to rest.
Her camp was in Denver, and was Denver like the spot to watch the eclipse?
Well, there were a number. So the total solar eclipse of 1878, the path of it went from Montana Territory down to Texas. And Denver was in the path. So were Dallas and Fort Worth. And there were a few scientific expeditions that went to Texas. But most were farther north because the odds of clear skies were better to the north in Wyoming and along the plains of Colorado. But there were folks spread out. The U.S. Naval Observatory put together, I think, six different expeditions out to the west, and they wanted them spread out with the idea that if clouds ended up disrupting the observations in one area, hopefully at least some other areas would be clear. But there, I, in writing my book, I put together a list of more than 70 scientists from the East and from Europe who came out to the west for this event. And I studied all of them, trying to figure out who would make the best characters for this book.
Well, was there a mass interest in the general population in going to witness the eclipse? I know that you're an advocate telling everyone that this is something that you owe it to yourself to experience at least once in your lifetime. Did people do that in 1878?
Yes. Now, there were eclipse tours back then. I mean, you could go on a tour to Denver, and there were many members of the public. I mean, you needed to be a person of means. There were senators and judges and others who decided to go on a vacation out to Colorado to see the eclipse and enjoy the Rocky Mountains. But, of course, it was not easy to get out there. So it wasn't the same mass migration that we will see on April 8th of this year. But it got tremendous, tremendous attention in the press, just like today. The newspapers were covering it. And even though you had to be in the West to see the total eclipse, it was a partial eclipse across the entire country. Again, that's the same on April 8th of this year. So everyone in the country knew about it. They were in New York City. They were going outside to watch it in Chicago. And one of the things I really enjoyed about writing this book about an eclipse from so long ago is that even though these people, if we were to meet them today, they would seem very odd. They would be wearing strange clothing. They would be thinking things about the world that are very different from us. Their technology, of course, would be rudimentary compared to what we're used to today. But even in 1878, the human experience of the total eclipse was identical to what it is today. When you read the diary entries and letters and articles that people wrote at the time about how they felt seeing the sun when the moon went in front of it, having this entirely different view of our solar system, feeling the power of nature, the adjectives they use are exactly the same ones that people use today.
Well, today I have these little cardboard glasses with a Mylar plastic thing for the lens for me to look at the eclipse. But did they have stuff like that?
Well, so they did things that today we would consider not smart. But they did do what they considered safe at the time. People would take very dark colored glass, like from a bottle, like green glass or blue glass, and look through it. Or what was a very popular thing to do is to take a piece of glass and hold it over a flame to get soot on it and to darken it. And they'd use that to look through. Again, do not do that today. We know that you're risking your vision to do that. Although I will say I didn't read of any mass problems of people going blind, but it's not a wise thing to do. Today we know with the eclipse glasses that you can get from a reliable seller or some libraries that are giving them out, those are safe to look at the sun with during a partial eclipse. And remember, if you're lucky enough to be in the path of the total eclipse, during those few minutes when it's total, you actually can and should take the glasses off. That's the only time it's safe to look with the naked eye.
Where are you going to be for this eclipse?
I will be in Waco. So I live in Colorado, but looking at the path of the total eclipse, it's obvious that the place to be in the United States is Texas, both because you've got the best odds of clear skies, and also because Texas is where the eclipse will last the longest. It'll be as long as 4.5 minutes in Texas, only 3.5 minutes by the time the moon's shadow gets to Maine. Waco is right near the center line of the path. It's a good spot to be in. And I also have a very, very unexpected reason why I'm going to be in Waco, which is that this book I wrote about the eclipse of 1878 has actually been turned into a musical. And it's going to see its premier performance, world premier performance, in a concert performance at Baylor University the weekend of the eclipse. So I will be there for that.
David Barron is the author of American Eclipse, A Nation's Epic Race to Catch the Shadow of the Moon and Win the Glory of the World. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. Email us at texasmatters@tpr.org. There are past Texas Matters programs on our website at tpr.org. You can download and subscribe to us wherever you find cool podcasts. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.
Support for TPR comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping employers get their people home safely. Preventing workplace accidents protects families and keeps businesses productive. More at texasmutual.com.